According to a Reuters poll, Steven Spielberg is the American public's clear favorite to win the Best Director Oscar later this month for his film about President Lincoln. That result might have more to do with Spielberg's enduring popularity than with insight about the politics of the Academy Awards. Spielberg has been nominated 7 times for Best Director and won 2 Oscars, for Schindler's List in 1993 and Saving Private Ryan in 1998. He has made some of the most popular films of all time, going from the young director playing with a big shark to a graying baby boomer paying respects to the World War II generation. Stay tuned for Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed and a Steven Spielberg appreciation. And welcome to Midday on Film, everyone, our monthly look at not only the current cinema, but the movies, movie makers, and movie stars of the past, in the hopes of providing historical, cultural, and artistic perspective for the many of our listeners who love film. Today, we consider Steven, a survey of the work of Steven Spielberg, who at 66 has been nominated for the 7th time for an Academy Award for Excellence in Cinematic Direction, this time for his film about Abraham Lincoln entitled Lincoln and starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Field. Steven Spielberg has won 2 Oscars for Schindler's List in 1993 and Saving Private Ryan in 1998, 2 director, Best Director Oscars. He has made some of the most popular films of all time, and today we'll survey Spielberg through the decades and ask what we expect of him. What, if anything, do we still want from him? And did we get what we expected to this point? And was it Lincoln? Joining me on the journey from Jaws to Jurassic Park to the Lincoln Bedroom are our Midday on Film contributors, Linda DeLibero, Associate Director of Film Studies at the Johns Hopkins University. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Dan.
Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
And Christopher Llewellyn Reed is here, filmmaker and associate professor and chair of film and video at Stevenson University. Nice to see you, Chris.
Nice to see you, Dan. Thanks.
Linda is just back from Sundance, too. You made another visit to the Sundance Festival?
Yes, sir.
Maybe toward the end of the show you'll slip in a couple of observations about Sundance.
I would love to.
But right now, why don't you approach Steven for us? How do you do this? There's so much work. I was looking at this thinking it's 4 decades. Actually, it's 5 or 6 decades of work if you go back to his early work. How do you approach Steven Spielberg?
It's hard to imagine that it's been so long, because he's kind of our boy wonder of a filmmaker.
Yes.
And by this time, you know, he's an icon, and he's also been held responsible for all sorts of sins in Hollywood cinema, from the blockbusterization of movies to the infantilization of movies. And traditionally, scholars and critics have given him a very hard time because he does, in some ways, give us what we want, which is hope. I think many of his movies end on a note of hope, optimism, despite all the darkness that we've seen. And today, I think he is getting a reappraisal from a lot of critics. People are beginning to look at his work much more seriously instead of dismissing it out of hand. I think there's really a knee-jerk tendency to say Spielberg's films are overly sentimental. They're simple. They're not complex. They're not full of ambiguity. But you know, I would have been first among those people to say those things. But you have to take a look at them. And he's I don't think anyone can gainsay his talent, his genius as a filmmaker. And when we look at the films carefully, I think there's a lot more going on there than most of his critics give him credit for.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you for addressing specifically that question about what is expected of Steven. What did we come to expect from Steven Spielberg? Thank you, brother. And Christopher Llewellyn Reed, I saw a tweet from you this week referring to it as Generation Spielberg. You feel like you've grown up with Steven Spielberg.
I do. I was born in 1969, and one of my first memories was being denied by my parents the right to see Jaws. So I was little too young.
You would have been six or seven years old,
right? 6 years old, and they rightfully determined that it was inappropriate. But one of my first film experiences in the actual theater that I remember seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981. And that if you'd been able to have a camera on my face in that moment, you would have seen a look of pure rapture watching that film. And so in many ways, for better and or for worse, I think the films of Steven Spielberg have shaped my aesthetic appreciation of films, either in reaction against or kind of in praise of his filmmaking. And I think that there are films both exceptional and mediocre in his canon. He has made, after all, 28 features, if you count his first made-for-television film, Duel, which we'll talk about later. But his best films, I think, rank among the best films ever made. And so I think that in spite of some of his failures, he really is one of the most influential filmmakers of all time, and certainly the most successful, purely based on box office. So he's a filmmaker to reckon with, and even if some people do think that his films are over-sentimental at times, and I am one of those people who thinks that some of his films sometimes overplay his hand, I nevertheless think that he knows how to tell a story and knows how to tell it well, and I think that that is one of the hardest things to do.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls during this hour of the show. We'd like to involve our listeners in this hour on Steven Spielberg. So this is what you can do. You can give us a ring at 410-662-8780 to answer specifically my question, what is your favorite moment of a Spielberg film? Please describe it for us, even if it's just briefly. And you can do that in an email to midday@wypr.org or post a brief description of your favorite moment from a Spielberg film on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. You mentioned Duel. D-U-E-L, which was produced and directed by Steven Spielberg just a couple of years after you were born, Chris. So I saw it on TV, and I must say I saw it on TV when it was first on television, and I was astonished. We were all in my household astonished that such a movie was made for television, because you didn't expect that much from made-for-TV films in 1971. So tell folks a little bit who may not be familiar with what Duel's about, and then set up the clip for us.
Absolutely. So it's also exceptional because it's one of the first films that Spielberg made for Universal. He'd kind of come on the lot in the 60s and ingratiated himself with the right people and was eventually given the opportunity to make a film like this, which was made for television but was released a few years later theatrically in Europe. So it's a film about a very large truck hunting down a poor, hapless driver played by Dennis Weaver.
Who was a very popular TV star
at the
time. Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. And he was kind of perfect for this part because he's not a heroic figure by any means. He's sort of an ordinary everyman. And there's never any reason given, really, for why the truck is chasing down this poor guy, except that he has at one point inadvertently cut him off on the road. And so the truck becomes this kind of larger-than-life figure of menace, much like the shark later in Jaws would be, or the T-Rex in Jurassic Park, this kind of figure of malice and menace. And it's really an incredibly economical film.
In this clip, Dennis Weaver is out of breath.
Dennis Weaver has just been driven off the road by the truck in one of their first encounters.
You all right, mister?
Yeah. Yeah, except... Oh, my neck.
You got a whiplash, probably.
Yeah, it's all right.
He's all right. What happened?
That truck driver tried to kill me.
Kill you? Go on.
It chased me down the mountain at nearly 90 miles an hour. I don't know what else you'd call it.
Tried to kill you. It sure looks like you got a whiplash, all right?
That's okay. It's okay.
Right. Anything I can do
for
you?
No, nothing. Thank you. No, it's okay.
Okay.
So, a little Walter Brennan there, too, wasn't there? But I remember that being very good and having Twilight Zone quality, right?
Absolutely. And as I was saying, it's incredibly economical. There's almost no dialogue. There obviously isn't that scene because I chose it for the radio. But otherwise, a large portion of the film is just, you know, the guy driving in his truck and chasing down Dennis Weaver in his pickup. So. Mm. And it's amazing what he can do with just that setup.
So cinematic. And it sets up a theme that recurs throughout Spielberg's work of the sort of lower middle class striver. This guy's a traveling salesman. He leads a really dull life. He's kind of a nervous Nelly, not terribly masculine. And here he's beset by this horrific terror and must come through in extraordinary circumstances and learn how to survive. And that is Spielberg over and over and over again.
So we recommend that one for you, Duel, if you've never seen it. Now, a few years later, 1974, The Sugarland Express, which, I'm sorry, I've never seen it. Linda, what can you tell us about the film? And then Chris will set up the clip.
This was Spielberg's first feature film, aside from Duel, which was, of course, made for TV, as we said. It is his art film, is what I like to think of it as. It was his pet project. It was his bid to make sure that people took him seriously as a filmmaker. He did not want to make blockbusters, strangely enough. This is a film about a couple who want to get back their child who's been adopted because they are outlaws, and they have a run across Texas that has every lawman in the state looking chasing after them. It's kind of a play on, you know, the 70s films of the couples on the run, like Badlands, Thieves Like Us, Bonnie and Clyde, those sorts of things. And the big star, Goldie Hawn, was in it, her first real dramatic role. Pauline Kael, the great New Yorker critic, absolutely loved it. It's really, I think it's a splendid film.
Oh, I got to see this.
And it did terribly at the box office.
Okay. So. It's all right. It was an art film.
Yes. Though not as bad as 1941 later.
No,
okay.
True.
That's also in the Spielberg canon. Yeah. Tell us about the clip.
So in this clip, Goldie Hawn is talking to her husband, played by William Atherton, who later had a career playing jerks in movies like Ghostbusters and Die Hard. And she's come to visit him in jail. And right before she springs him from jail, she tells him that their child has been taken away from her. And that's kind of the catalyst that motivates the plot.
What's the matter, honey? Going shy on me?
I come with the bad news. I'm leaving you.
What kind of junk are you talking?
We are no longer man and wife. That's what I come to tell you. I'm leaving you.
I suppose that's why you brought your lunch?
This don't mean nothing. I'm already on my way. Don't you notice nothing? Don't you notice anything?
You're going blonde. You're going blonde before.
Columbus Poplin, have you forgotten your own son?
Why didn't you bring him? There's kids a lot here, Lou Jean. They got candy for him and pop. I'm not behind bars in despair. You can bring him next time. You can bring him every week.
That's what I come to tell you. Welfare's come and taken baby Langston forever. They're going to keep him in that foster home.
Thank you very much. Sugarland Express, a clip chosen by Chris Reed.
So as you can hear, she's very much in distress, and that kind of emotion is what drives the rest of the chase. It's a chase movie, actually, very much like Duel was a chase movie, just with a different basic plot. So you can see that in Hollywood, when you're successful at one thing, they ask you to do something else that's similar enough. But it is a very powerful and successful movie on narrative terms, and it's too bad it didn't make more money, but it certainly didn't ruin his career because the critics liked it and he got another chance to make
Jaws. A year later, 1975, if you go to the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, I posted a photograph of Steven Spielberg on location filming Jaws, I guess in 1974 probably, and Walter Cronkite's in the picture. I read that they were going to use Walter Cronkite as a news announcer in Jaws, in the film, reporting about the menacing shark off the coast of Amity. But CBS wouldn't let him do it. So they went to ABC and got Howard K. Smith. But anyway, okay. So Jaws, you picked a clip from Jaws. Should we just jump right into this?
Sure, let's just jump right in.
Let's just jump right in. The water's fine.
Well, what else could have done that to that girl? Boat to belly?
Well, I think possibly, yes, a boating
accident. That's not what you told me over the phone.
I was wrong. We'll have to amend our reports.
And you'll stand by
that? I'll stand by you.
Pardon me. A summer girl goes swimming. Swims out a little far. She tires. Fishing boat comes along.
It's happened before.
I don't think you appreciate the gut reaction people have to these things.
Harry, I appreciate it. I'm just reacting to what I was told.
Martin, it's all psychological. You yell Barracuda.
Everybody says,
huh? What? You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
That's great stuff. Roy Shard as the sheriff, right?
Yep.
Poor Roy.
Poor Roy.
He was really overwhelmed by this. But he comes through in the end, as we all know. What do you want to say about Jaws?
I think it's really an exceptional film. I show it in class all the time because almost every scene is perfectly crafted. He had a lot of help from a very experienced editor, Verna Fields, who probably deserves as much of the credit for the success of this film as Spielberg did. But you know, he shot the film well under extremely difficult and challenging circumstances because the shark kept on not working, the model of the shark, until he figured out that, hey, guess what? They didn't have to show the shark. They'd made the decision to shoot on location rather than in studios, which complicated matters. But ultimately, I think it's one of the most kind of successful monster movies ever made, and deservedly launched the career of the man who became, quote, Steven Spielberg, unquote, rather than just a director named Steven
Spielberg.
What
would you say is the test of a successful monster movie? The fact that people are willing to see it many times? Because, well, I mean, every time I watch it, I feel like that I'm seeing something new each time or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's impossible to replicate the shock, the trauma, the excitement that this film caused when it came out. Mm-hmm. And people, it literally kept people from going into the water. And to this day, you know, it has sort of the effect of Psycho and Showers. And it was indeed a disastrous shoot. They didn't have a script when they started. Everything went wrong. Verna Fields, the editor, is credited with saving the picture because she said to Spielberg, just don't show the shark until, you know, more than halfway through the film. And through editing, they were able to create the surprise and not make Bruce the shark look absolutely phony and ridiculous. But this became a cultural phenomenon, and it also changed the way the studios released movies. It really was the first real blockbuster, and that is something that
summer
has been...
Summer blockbuster.
Yeah, in particular, but the idea of opening the film wide in, I think, over 400 theaters, advertising it on television, all of that was new, and that... From that point on, Spielberg was held responsible for creating this blockbuster monster as well as this the shark monster.
Mike, one of our listeners in Hamden, writes to say one of his favorite scenes in all of Spielberg films is from Jaws, when Sheriff Brody tells his fellow shark hunters we're going to need a bigger boat. He says, Jaws remains my favorite Spielberg film. I have to confess, I took my boys, then 9 and 7, to see the film shortly before I took them to spend a few weeks with their grandparents in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. They were okay after a couple of days. This is Midday on Film. Dan Roderick's with Christopher Reed and Linda DeLibero. If you'd like to join us, 410-662-8780. Your favorite scene, your favorite moment from a Steven Spielberg film as we continue our appreciation of this great director. Sat next to my brother Eddie at Jaws. Eddie hadn't seen it, I had. I knew what was coming. He literally actually jumped out of the chair when the Richard Dreyfuss is in scuba gear and he's underneath, he's examining the hull of a boat that's been attacked, right?
And the face comes right out at him.
The face comes out at him. My brother Eddie just...
I screamed the first time I saw the film when that moment happened.
That's great.
All right, let's move on here to another Steven Spielberg film. I love this one. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right? Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Speaking again of Richard Dreyfuss, right?
Indeed. For a while, Richard Dreyfuss was Spielberg's alter ego on screen. Mm-hmm. Kind of an everyman, a bit of an intellectual, not the muscular hero, but who could solve problems just by rationalizing his way through them. And in this film, he plays a man obsessed with an image that turns out to be Devil's Tower in Wyoming, and obsessed with music that keeps on playing in his head. And it's an amazingly ambitious film, given that it's only his third theatrical feature, and so ambitious that he even puts the well-known French New Wave director François Truffaut in a main role. So that's gutsy, I have to say.
I thought that was pretty cool when Truffaut shows up in this film. But what's the clip, Chris?
So this is a clip when they're first encountering the aliens at Devil's Tower, and they're playing what they think is the musical language to which it will respond. And this is one of John Williams' most famous themes.
Go ahead.
Sounds good.
Go. Okay. Start with the tone.
Tang.
Go. Up a full tone. Down a major third. Now drop an octave.
Cool blue.
Go. Up a perfect fifth. Nothing. Nothing at all.
We have a possible anomaly ranging from plus 5 milligals to minus 15 milligals.
Give me a tone.
Ray to the second.
Up a full tone.
Me to the third.
Down a major third.
No to the first.
Drop an octave.
Soul to the fifth.
Why do you like that so much? I mean, I like it. Is it because of everything that's going on that you have a feeling this is real science? These are men from government and scientists actually trying to pull this off. Can you forgive me for saying that when I walked out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind for the first time, I said to whoever was with me, I said, you know, if this ever happens, if aliens ever come to visit, that's pretty much the way it's going to happen. It's going to happen like this because it seems so real to me, you know?
It did until they opened the spaceship and the little kind of bulbous-headed yeah. aliens came yeah. out. That was the one part yeah. of the film I didn't like.
I almost didn't want to see that, right? I almost didn't want to see that. Right?
Yeah, up yeah. until then, I'm with you 100%.
Yeah. And it's kind of what you want it to be about, right?
Yeah, that's sort of peaceful.
It's magical. Yeah. It's fantastical, but
no one's killing anybody,
right? But what I find really interesting about the film is the family situation,
and it's great.
Maybe here is the place to talk about great. Spielberg's treatment of women, which
Terry
has
Gar,
always
Terry Gar.
Been a little bit
poor Terry Gar,
yeah. ambivalent. Yes, the family man Roy Neary, who is obsessed. And eventually leaves his family after basically abandoning them to his obsession. And the wife does not understand. She's kind of not a very sympathetic character. And he does meet up with this other woman, played by Melinda Dillon, who shares his obsession. But unlike other movies of this ilk, he does not end up with her as a romantic partner. They're just kind of buddies going along on this adventure together. Spielberg is one of the most, shall we say, innocent, naive directors when it comes to sexual relations. Some people would say infantile, but he's always very ambivalent about women. And the idea that he creates some sort of suburban utopia in his films, I think this film absolutely refutes that. The suburbia is always fraught with complications. It's ugly, it's lonely, it's a place to escape from. And that's exactly what happens in this film.
A comment from Lorraine on Close Encounters before we move on to the next film. She says, in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when Richard Dreyfuss is building the mound of dirt, the Devil's Tower, on the table in his living room or dining room table in frustration, hoping to make sense of this image he knows he's seen but can't place, suddenly it appears on local television, right, or national TV. And that's relief. She says, that's how I feel when I'm searching for my keys. I can always see them in my mind's eye somewhere. So that's her favorite moment from a Spielberg film. Thank you for that, Lorraine. If anyone wants to share one with us, please give us a ring. Let's take this call here because I think it fits in with what Linda DeLibero was just talking about a bit. Suzanne in Baltimore with a comment about Spielberg films. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to say, Suzanne?
I wanted to say first that there's a thread that runs through a lot of Spielberg films, and I always thought if I ever had to write a thesis, that would be it. It's about the fact that kids are basically left on their own, abandoned by families, whether it's war or divorce or happenstance. And my favorite Spielberg film is Empire of the Sun. And I guess the moment that absolutely shook me to the core was when that woman was in the field, and then there was the explosion, which was actually Hiroshima. And it was actually, they were in a war camp. But this kid just emerged, and then he was reunited with his family. It was the most gripping So,
well, listen, Suzanne, I appreciate you calling. Actually, I wanted to talk about Empire of the Sun myself a little bit today. And I thought when she started off talking about the abandonment of children, it wasn't so much the abandonment of children. It's just this scene in Empire of the Sun in Shanghai. The Japanese have invaded. This British family, along with everybody else, is thrown into this utter chaos and fear and terror. And they're separated. The father. Let's play it. Please play this. This is a clip I chose. I mean, the panic that you feel in this scene. The claustrophobia, the panic, the desperation as the boy played by Christian Bale, who's probably, 12 years old in this film, maybe?
12 to 14.
Is separated from his parents. We'll just listen a little bit.
Hold on! Stay together! John! Hang on to Jamie!
You get such creeps from this, and it's so bitterly sad as the boy finds himself separated from his parents, doesn't know when he'll see them again. The whole war is out in front. I think this is 1938. You know, the several years are going to transpire before anything. There's any hope of him seeing his parents. He doesn't even think of that, and he gets separated. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that in. If you've never had the pleasure of seeing that film, I think it's an underrated Spielberg film.
I just rewatched it this week, and it's risen in my estimation. I will say, just in response to Suzanne's comments, that Spielberg was himself a child of divorced parents, and I think running throughout his work is this theme of lost boys, lost children, which is why it's ironic that his one film in which there are literal lost boys, Hook, was not more successful, because he's very, very almost obsessed with this idea of children struggling to keep their heads above water in a family unit that's breaking apart or with only one parent. And as a result, he's not always kind to single moms. Or to women in general, as Linda was saying. But mm-hmm. That's his primary focus, is the plight of the children.
Yeah. Phoebe, just let me add this. Phoebe posted on Facebook, Empire of the Sun, where Jim sings the Welsh song, and then he breaks down admitting he's forgotten what his parents look like because of the war years and the separation. This is one of the movies I saw as a kid that really opened my mind to the world. I recommend it if you haven't had a chance to see it. And speaking of children trying to deal with a situation, E.T. is next on our list, although we stepped a little bit out of the chronology here. E.T. actually was made before Empire of the Sun, and we'll get to The Color Purple in a moment, too. So E.T.
I don't think this clip needs any introduction.
No?
It's right after E.T.'s resurrection, and people will, I'm sure, recognize the scene because it features an iconic line, probably the most iconic line of the early
80s. Okay. All right. Well, listen. Yeah.
E.T. phone home. Home.
Does this mean they're coming?
Yes. E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home.
Stay.
E.T. phone home.
Shut up.
Phone home.
Quiet.
Phone.
E.T. phone
home. Phone home.
Linda, my mother, the late former Rose Popolo, the late Rose Rodericks, she loved this movie. She wasn't a movie watcher, really. She loved this movie. She's also very Catholic, so I think she appreciated the resurrection.
Oh, yes.
Maybe
absolutely.
More than other people did.
How ironic that the nice Jewish boy has created a resurrection, a Christ symbol. And this is not one of my favorite films because of the overt sentimentality. And I found actually a quote that's kind of funny. When Spielberg was making the movie with John Williams, his constant companion composer, and who has composed all the music for his films, very famously over the top, I have to say. And Williams is setting down the music for the final scene in E.T., which is, of course, heartbreaking. And he says to Spielberg, "This is shameless. Will we get away with it?" And Spielberg says, "Movies are shameless."
That's great. Thank you, Linda. We have to switch to a different period, I think. We're running into a different period here with Spielberg, or at least a different kind of film for him as we get into The Color Purple. But before we do that, why don't we take a couple more calls? Because I've asked folks to share their own thoughts about this, their favorite scenes from or favorite moments from Spielberg films. And Tom wants to take us back a step to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1977. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Dan. There are two, it's this theme of icons that this guy created. And I'm not a big movie watcher either, but Close Encounters, there's an amazing moment where we come to the Devil's Tower finally, and we see the Devil's Tower in the distance. And we know it's a mountain, and it's our scale of reference. And we're looking up at this mountain expecting to see something come down and land on top of the mountain. Instead, it rises behind the mountain and fills the screen. It's the first time we see the mothership. Mm. And the shift of scale, I can remember my stomach almost falling out in the theater because suddenly it was like vertigo. An amazing scene, and it's a good I'm a cartoonist, and so I think of shifting scales and the way you can affect somebody, the reader, that way by just suddenly having something giant appear.
Right. Mm. And Chris Reed, maybe you could help me with this. You know what Tom's talking about is that use of, you see this in other Spielberg films too. I think you see it in the Indiana Jones films. Somebody might be, walking up a ridge of some kind, and then suddenly the whole scene opens up and there's this massive panorama.
Well, he does it in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you kind of get this incredible panorama of the archaeological dig, where you get Indy walking up a hill and you've got the big sunset behind him. He even uses that kind of iconography in E.T. with, of course, the moon, and then later on it's the same shot but with the sun. So he loves these big vistas with these kind of over-large visual iconography. So,
right. Yeah. Well, he knew when he's making E.T., Linda, he's making a children's film too, right? He
knows that, right? Oh, absolutely, but for adult children too. Mm-hmm. He described one of the iconic moments in his childhood as being a night when his father took him to see shooting stars, and looking up in this field at these stars overhead falling over him, and that really became an image that so struck him with wonder that kind of feeling is what he tries to capture in his films, particularly in these science fiction films.
Linda DeLibro and Christopher Llewellyn Reed are regular contributors here to Midday on Film. We'll take another break here when we come back. Your phone calls, more comments, and more clips from Steven Spielberg films as we take a look at the work of this director, now nominated again for Academy Award, this time for Lincoln. We'll be right back. Kristen points out something from Jaws. Kristen's favorite little moment from Jaws. Kristen says it's a throwaway. Chief Brody comments to a guy sitting on Amity's beach, "That's some bad hat, Harry." She says, "I love this, especially because it's a tagline after some TV shows now, I assume associated with a production company, so I get to hear it now and then." Emily says, "I will never forget the girl in the red dress from Schindler's List. I'm not sure I could watch that movie again, though. The whole audience was sobbing in the theater." We'll get to Schindler's List in just a moment as we move along here through the canon of work of Steven Spielberg with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. We can't obviously get to every film, but we'd like to move now to The Color Purple. And I said this is a different period. It's a different type of film. I'm not sure people expected. We talk about expectations with Steven Spielberg. Did people expect Steven Spielberg to take on this project?
The film he made right before this was a sequel to Indiana Jones. So he'd made primarily what a lot of people would consider popcorn films. And then he made a conscious effort to kind of change the kind of film he was making. Linda pointed out that with Sugarland Express, he was trying to make an art film, but then he sort of got sidetracked into these blockbusters. And with The Color Purple, he really tried to make, for him, a completely different kind of film. And I have a quote here that I think is very interesting from Spielberg, where he says, "The big difference in The Color Purple is that the story is not bigger than the lives of these people. I didn't want to make another movie that dwarfs the characters. But here, the characters are the story." Right. So that's how he feels about the film.
Mm-hmm. And the clip you chose for this?
The clip stars Oprah Winfrey, who plays a woman who's got her two kids, and she's approached by the wife of the white mayor of the town, who makes her an offer that apparently she can refuse. And she responds in a way that gets her into enormous trouble with the white establishment. Her name is, her character's name is Sophia.
That's the cutest blue face I ever saw. Can you give me some sugar?
Miss Millie always going on over the cup.
You children are so clean. Would you like to work for me? Be my maid?
Hell no.
What did you say?
Hell no.
What did she say?
Hey, can't you pump that crude a little faster?
Gail, what did you say to Miss Millie?
I said, hell.
No, Miss Sophia.
No, Miss Sophia, no!
And of course, she responds by being slapped by hitting the mayor in turn, and that lands her in jail.
All right. There's so much in Oprah's face and expression in that scene, as I recall.
Yeah.
So, Linda, what could you say about Steven Spielberg turning toward this kind of project, and then later on, as we get to Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan, I mean, as you move along here, Amistad is another one we should mention.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that shift?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge shift, very unexpected, I think. And, of course, he took an enormous amount of criticism. A white Jewish man taking on this novel, a wildly popular novel by Alice Walker, a black woman, and handling this material, I don't think there was any way he could have won in terms of the critical reception, although it was a very successful film, very popular film. And I think this is what he has continued to do now. I don't think he was ever particularly wedded to the idea of being a blockbuster filmmaker. And he unfairly gets lumped with, I think, George Lucas in particular for creating this blockbuster mentality when he's a really smart guy. He wants to tackle difficult material. And certainly, this is not one of my favorite films, but I think you have to give him a lot of credit for having taken this on at a time when very few directors, black or white, would have taken this on. And he has done this over and over again to greater or lesser success.
One of our listeners, Maya, refers to Amistad, the Spielberg film Amistad, which I'm not sure, where does it fall in chronologically here?
It's after Schindler's List, before the sequel to Jurassic Park, okay. So 1997.
Yeah, she remembers the scene in the courtroom where the exclamation is, "Give us free." I'm not surprised to hear someone mention that. He jumps back here to Indiana Jones again. Because there's three of those, right?
There's
four of them. Yeah. And he's actually, so he's moving through in both of these, I don't know if you call them genre, I guess, subject matter, certainly back to the, you know, the Saturday matinee big blockbuster. And this one is Emperor, I'm sorry, this is Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
The Last Crusade. It's the third in the series. It sort of redeems him after the not-so-successful Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and he brought Sean Connery in to play Harrison Ford's father. It's a delightful film. And just to go to what you're saying, going back and forth in genres, that's part of, I think, why the critics have had trouble taking him seriously, because unlike the idea of the auteur or author, he's not consistent in the kind of film he makes. But I think, you know, who cares, right? The films that he makes that are successful on their own terms. And Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is one of those.
So by now, it's 2013. By now, you would expect almost anything from Steven Spielberg, right?
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Could we say that? I mean, you wouldn't be surprised at any kind of project he would have taken.
Well, he actually gave an interview, I believe it was in November, on Oprah, which I did not see. But apparently he said there that he could make an adventure film in his sleep now, and he wasn't really interested in doing that anymore. So who knows? I'll bet any money that He may have actually one more in him at least. But it goes back to that idea that this is a director who is going to take risks. Of course, he's in a perfect position to do so. He can pretty much make whatever he wants. But other directors in that position would probably just recreate the formula for success over and over again, and he has chosen not to do that.
We're going to move along to Jurassic Park next. Is that okay?
That sounds great.
What clip did you pick for this?
In Jurassic Park, I picked a clip that I think really gets at some of the heart of themes that are dear to Spielberg. He's deeply anti-authoritarian, and also a lot of his films deal with this idea of hubris, of people overreaching and then suffering the consequences thereof. And in this scene, Malcolm, the chaos theory mathematician played by Jeff Goldblum, is expressing his opinion of why this venture into re-engineering the dinosaur could not go so well.
Yeah, don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
It's hardly appropriate to start hurling generalizations.
If I may,